So, I thought long and hard about what I would talk to you about today. And I'm going to be a little brave here and share with you a personal story that not many of you may know about. When I went into an Indian restaurant that's near my house, I think it was on my first or second date with a man named Bruce, who many of you have met. We went into this Indian restaurant because it's a great restaurant, and I know the owner there, and we sat down, and the owner came up, and he gave me a big hug, and he says, "Hi, Tracy, it's so great to see you. Do you still have your worms?" Pretty sure that was our second date, and I was mortified. Mortified, because he has kind of a loud voice, so a lot of people in the restaurant heard him say this. And what he didn't know is that at that point, I was just finishing up having had a vermiculture business. Did you all know that I used to do this? Yeah, that's because I don't tell people. So when I graduated from seminary and started the search process, it took some time. There was a gap of many months when I was looking for a job but hadn't found one yet and had to do something with my time. So on my mother's birthday, which is on Earth Day, I asked her if she would be, like a vermicomposter. She's got a big garden. She's into composting. She's very concerned about organic gardening and taking care of the earth. And so I bought her a little vermicomposter. This is like a plastic box that has trays that you can stack, and you put some bedding in there, like wet newspaper or shredded mulchy stuff. And then I ordered a pound of worms through the mail. You can do that. You can order a pound of worms live through the mail and put them in there, and then you feed them your kitchen scraps. And so I got this little thing set up for her, figuring, I did the calculations based on how much worms eat and how much sort of kitchen waste, vegetable scraps that we were producing. 1 pound of worms should be able to handle her, mine, and my two children's scraps while we were living there. And thus began my little experiment in vermicomposting. So when we read this story, how many people have heard of the story of creation from the Bible? You've heard of it. How many people have actually read it from start to finish, the first three chapters of Genesis? How many people have not read it from start to finish? A few people. Okay. So that's actually a really high percentage. I've been to many churches where they've been told the story over and over for years, but they've never actually read it, which leads to some disconnects. You might be surprised to know how many people know that the earth was created in 6 days, but don't know that they were created in God's image. You'd be surprised to learn how many people have never been told you are created in the image of God, but they know that God created the earth in 6 days. That Adam was created sec or that Eve was created second to Adam, but not that men and women were created simultaneously and God blessed them both. Do you hear the disconnect in that story? Humankind was created, and then later, God created Adam. Did you hear that? A lot of people don't realize that there are two separate stories in there. Or that things, little idiosyncrasies, like that God created all of the planets, including the sun and the moon and the stars, but that was 3 days after God created night and day. So we've got this little vermicomposter going, and we're throwing our little, potato peelings and vegetable matter in there every day. My mother thought it was a great idea, but she didn't actually do anything with it. I was the one that was tending it. And all of a sudden, those worms got fruitful and multiplied. I mean, rapidly, rapidly. You knew what they were doing. You could hear the Barry White late at night out in the backyard. You find the empty, champagne bottles the next morning, and all of a sudden, 1 pound of worms turned into probably more like 5 or 6 pounds of worms. They were rapidly expanding, and you could see the little worm eggs that were all peppering this thing. So there were more and more being born every single day, and they were rapidly, exponentially multiplying. They were being fruitful and multiplying, if you will, which meant that they needed more kitchen scraps. So, so in this story, we hear a very orderly, explanation of how the world was created and how the world itself is very orderly. For example, it goes to the trouble, it's a very short story, but it goes to the trouble of explaining that God didn't just create trees and plants. God created trees that bore fruit, where each fruit contained the seeds of the tree to make the same kind of tree. It's a very, they went to a, for such a short story, they went to a lot of trouble to explain that detail. You can't take an apple and pull the seeds out and plant it and have asparagus come up. This is orderly. Everything has its own kind. You can't, you know, have a bunch of cattle in the field and all of a sudden they'll start giving birth to fish. Everything is very orderly. And he specifically says that the plants and the green things are for the animals to eat, and all the fruit trees are for the human beings to eat. If you disrupt this system, things on the planet will not have enough to eat. Now we know that this story, it's a wonderful story, but it is etiology. It is a story of the way things came to be, how things came to be. It is not an actual depiction of what actually happened. We know science tells us very different. But what's interesting about it, that a lot of people don't realize, is that there are in fact two separate stories. There is the first creation story, and then there's a little interlude, and then there is the second creation story. The first creation story has the world being created in 6 days, with human beings being created on the final day, and then God resting on the last day, on the seventh. Then there's a little interlude, and then it moves on into the story of Adam and Eve. And what's interesting about these is not only that there's two of them, but that they go in reverse order. In the first story, you have the fish in the seas and the plants on the ground, and then all of the animals being created, and then humankind being created last. In the second story, you have God on a stark landscape, picking up some dust, forming it into a human being, and breathing breath into it. And then he's got to figure out where he's going to put this person. And so he creates a garden, and he fills it with plants and fruit trees, and sticks the person in the garden. In the garden, the person is lonely, so God creates all of the animals. The person is still lonely, so then God creates another person to be with him. You see that? Two completely separate stories. And people have sort of mushed them together. You know, you hear people say, yeah. In the Bible, it says the world was created in 6 days, and Adam and Eve were the first people. But that's leaving out a lot of discrepancies in that story. So as these worms were rapidly multiplying, I realized that they were going to need another food source. So there was a little cafe I used to go to for coffee that also served sandwiches. And I noticed that they just threw away all of their scraps. You know, they would hack the end off of a piece of lettuce to make the sandwiches and then throw away the piece of, you know, throw away the end of the lettuce. Take the core out of the tomatoes, chuck those, use the rest of the tomato, but not the end, throw that away too. Loaves of bread and stuff, the ends of the bread they would throw away. And so I just checked in with them and I said, you know, if I were to bring you a bucket every day or every few days and just put it right here next to your counter, could you put in all of your green waste and I will use it to feed my worms? And they said, that's great, because then their garbage bill goes down, right? Because those were the heaviest things. You know, tomatoes and vegetables are way heavier than like, you know, paper towels or whatever. So I started doing that. And there was another place, the Indian restaurant I went to, because so many of the things that they cooked were vegetarian. I said, you know, no meat, but everything else, if I brought you a bucket or two, would you save these things for me? And they said, sure. So I started collecting, and the worms kept multiplying. The more I fed them, the more they multiplied. So I was at the point where I think 4 or 5 times a week, I would drive my little Honda Accord down to like 3 different restaurants, fill it with buckets in the back of my car, 8 or 10, full 10-gallon buckets, filled to the brim with stuff, bring them back home, and then feed them to the worms. This is what I was doing with my time. This is why you don't want to see me unemployed. It gets ugly really fast. So this is what I was doing. And then I was to do a large project because then I had to wash out 10 buckets almost every single day, like scrub them out, because you can't take a dirty bucket back to a restaurant and have them put it in their kitchen. So it was quite a production every day that I was doing. So as we look at this story, we have to try and figure out what they are telling us about God. We know that it is not a scientifically accurate depiction of evolution and of how the world came to be. Scientists have really good theories on that. Nobody's 100% sure, but we're pretty sure that it didn't happen in the order as it is displayed in this story. But the people are trying to do two things. They're trying to explain how things came to be. And the author's also trying to explain to people in a particular context how God works and what God looks like and how God relates to the planet, to the people, to the animals, and to all living beings. And so it's really important to recognize that the story as we have it now, the earliest version of this story that we have is from the Greek. It's from the Septuagint. The Septuagint, from the word sept meaning seven, is a translation of the Pentateuch, penta meaning five. Getting way too much into terminology here, but the Pentateuch is the first five books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, which is the story of creation and the patriarchs, how the people got into Egypt and then were led out of Egypt by Moses, and then all of the laws that he brought down from Mount Sinai before they went into the Promised Land. That's the Pentateuch. And at a certain point, about 300 years before Jesus was born, Greek became the language of the day, and it was becoming more and more prominent. And the rabbis were concerned that this piece of literature, that this book, their Torah, their Pentateuch, people wouldn't be able to read it anymore because it was in an ancient language that was quickly disappearing. And so they ordered a translation to be done into the Greek. And some really interesting things happened there because, first of all, we know what they selected. We don't know what they rejected when they decided to canonize this. They made decisions. This is the book. This is what we're going to be translating. This will be the official version. The other thing that we see is little hints throughout the text that refer to but don't directly state things from the Greek culture. And that's where we get to some really interesting things about what this is trying to tell us about God. So the Greek, I looked this up last year. I was really interested to find out, as I'm seeing more and more little references to Greek culture in this story, I started looking into Greek culture to find out what it looked like, to see if there were more references that I wasn't picking up on. Like one is when they talk about the Nephilim. This is around the time of Moses. There's a little reference in there that says they're worried that people are living too long. God and his little consort are worried that people are living too long. And they don't want them to be like us because it said the angels of God were coming back and forth between heaven and earth and intermarrying with the women. And all of a sudden they were having these people that were living extraordinarily long lives. So God put a stop to that. They were called the Nephilim. Well, that's a direct reference to Greek culture because in the Greek myths, right, the gods are always coming back and forth between the earth and the heavens and intermarrying with the women. And then you get these demigods, which we love to hear about, like Achilles and these sorts of things. What's the other one? There's so many of them that they're running around and they have superpowers and they live extraordinary long lives. They're not gods, but they're like demigods. Do you see that? And so that little reference in there was a way to say, yeah, that's the way it used to be. But then our God put a stop to that. And from here on out, there is one God and there are people, not in between. Do you see that? It's a really neat way of wrapping up what people might have been thinking about absorbing from Greek culture and putting it aside and negating it without actually saying it. Do you see that? Okay, so there's more in here. Here's the thing. This was translated in the city of Alexandria, which is in Egypt, and it was home to the largest Jewish community that was known at that time, 300 BC. And in this town, there were three main components. There was the Jewish community, there was the Egyptian quarter, and then there was the Greek quarter. It was also home to one of the largest libraries, which would only allow books into the library if they were translated into Greek first, which I wonder if it wasn't an impetus to get this translation going. So, the Egyptian quarter and the Jewish quarter, this is what I learned, were right next door to each other. And in the Egyptian quarter, there was a gigantic temple built for Sipparis, which was the Egyptian god. Every time the Jewish people came out of their quarter, they had to see this. If they wanted to go to the library, they had to look at it on their way. And they had two gigantic statues outside of it that had the symbols for this god. Guess what the symbols for this god were? A bull and a snake. Bull and a snake. Now, what is the first creature that Adam and Eve come in contact with in the garden that ends up getting crushed under God's heel? Because it's evil and tempting, and he doesn't want them talking to it anymore. The snake. Right. So, well, that's my own personal opinion. It's just an opinion. It's just a thought. It's an educated guess, but it's just a thought. Doesn't prove anything. But then we come to the story of Exodus, where Moses leads the people out into the desert, and they keep complaining about how they want to go back to Egypt. And it was so much better in Egypt. It wasn't Egypt so great? Why can't we just go back to Egypt? At least we had food there. Moses goes up the mountain to talk to God for a couple of minutes. And while they're up there, what do the people create that God puts a smackdown on? The golden calf. The golden calf. That's right. And in that story, that golden calf is destroyed. The people are banned from ever doing it again. And they are presented with a new set of laws so they don't ever have to look back. Do you see that? Again and again and again, we see this in this scripture. So, what does this tell us about people's understanding of how God worked? To this, we look at the structure of the story. It's orderly. We see that God was very methodical in creation. Everything is interconnected to everything else. Everything is built and structured to be able to be fruitful and to be able to multiply. Everything works in harmony with each other. Everything has a purpose, and everything's purpose is designated for somebody else's purpose. The plants are designated to be able to feed the animals. The trees are designated to be able to nourish the humans. The humans are there to be able to caretake the whole creation. Everything works in synchronicity with each other. Do you see that? That's very orderly. It's very well thought out. So by this, we're able to conclude that of all the denominations, God was clearly a Methodist. Do we see that? Very methodical. Yeah. God was not a UCC. We're a little too chaotic for that. God was definitely a Methodist. But we also see, if you look at the structure of the Greek gods, I've read the creation story from the Greek gods, and it starts with a god was born and created the sky. God gave birth to another god that then created that created the earth, which gave birth to another god, which created the waters, which gave birth to another god, which then became the god of the animals. And every single thing was created by a god that was given birth to by another god. Do you see that? So in this creation story, we see them addressing that issue. God created everything. One God, one singular God, created everything. Everything that has its own God in Greek culture, our God created that. One and only one. The be-all, end-all of creative, life-giving force created this. So, the other thing that we learn about this scripture is when we look at the two different creation stories, which are opposites of each other almost, opposites, we see two similarities. First of all, in both stories, human beings are given dominion over creation and expected to take care of it. That does not change. Human beings are given dominion over creation and expected to caretake it. The other thing is, in both stories, though Adam and Eve has been widely mistranslated and widely misunderstood, in both stories, men and women are created simultaneously. Because in the story of Adam and Eve, Adam, the word that they use for that name, Adama, it's a play on words. It means humankind, an earth person. The word for human and the word for earth are very similar, so they make a play on words, right? He's created out of earth. He's an earth person, gender neutral. And he continues being a gender neutral earth person until Eve is created. God puts the earth person to sleep, pulls a rib out of earth person, and all of a sudden we have the word for woman. A woman is created. And after that point, earth person is referred to as a man. Do you see that? They were created simultaneously, male and female. And in the original story, in the first story, we see God created humankind, male and female, he created them. It was simultaneous. So we see a God that created male and female together, simultaneously, one from the other. The first could not exist without the second. The second would never have existed if the first had not been created from the second. And the second and the first are so intercombined, you cannot say that one came before the other. They came into existence because they came into existence together. Does that make sense? It's very different from what we've been told in our Sunday school classes. The other thing that we learn about how early people understood God is that we are created in the image of God. And it's all good. Everything that God created is good. There is no bad that was created. There is no evil that was created. Every single thing on this planet is good. It's blessed. It says that explicitly. We are blessed, and it is very good. And that's important to remember. It's very important to remember when we throw around words like evil or this person is expendable or, you know, little jokes like, why didn't God leave the mosquitoes off the ark? I mean, really. Why didn't Noah just, you know, leave those mosquitoes off the ark and leave them behind? So my worms were quickly outgrowing their little vermicomposter. It was only about this big. And in order to keep putting food in, I had to switch the trays every day, which was not how it was intended to be used. And they were really heavy. So then I started looking online to figure out how to make more. I didn't want to buy more. That little sucker was $110. Well, I'm not going to buy 8 more of those, which was about what I needed. So I started going to the Goodwill and finding Rubbermaid tubs for just $1 and $2 each, you know, used tubs, drilling holes in the bottom of them, inserting, you know, pipes so that I could keep the air flowing, you know, and then getting them set up and started splitting the worms out to these. Well, those were really heavy. Every time I wanted to move them, I had to pick them up. And lifting a Rubbermaid tub filled with wet dirt is really hard. And also, it was kind of messy. I had to, like, dig in there to put food in and stuff. It was really gross. So I looked and found a different design. They call it the airflow design. You're learning way more about vermicomposting than you probably ever wanted to know. But an airflow design. So I took a tall garbage can. I actually spent money on this. A tall garbage can that was on wheels. See, then I didn't have to lift it. You know, a big 32-gallon like you'd have outside. And I started drilling holes in the bottom and putting pipes in so that you can just put stuff in on top. The worms stay at the bottom. They eat things. And then you just turn these little cranks. Yeah, I put this together. The cranks with, like, screws on the pipes so that as it rolled around, all the finished compost would just fall out the bottom. You just had to put stuff in on top. You didn't have to ever dig or move it or lift it or anything like that. That worked really well until it got too heavy on the top that the whole thing collapsed. The garbage can, I'm not kidding you, I have pictures. The garbage can bent in half. Where I had drilled the holes, it was a weak point, and the garbage can literally bent in half. And even once I emptied it out, I couldn't unbend it. So I came up with a different design. I reverse engineered something that I saw in a smaller version online, and I created it out of fabric. Recycled bottles had been made into felt, and I made a double thick funnel about this big, about 3 feet by 3 feet on the top, to make a funnel that came down like this and had a drawstring on the bottom. Same idea. You put your bedding and your food and your worms in there, and they eat it, and then you just open the bottom, and all the compost falls out the bottom. So I made one. It worked really well, but it wasn't enough. So then I started manufacturing these things. I ended up having 9 of them going in my mother's garage. At one point, they were so heavy I had to bolt them to the walls. In the meantime, I'm collecting for more and more restaurants every single day, and this suddenly became a full-time job, and I realized I had too many worms. So I contacted some companies around the country and became a drop shipper. Can you imagine this? I've spent my time, I can remember many a late evening, at 11 o'clock at night, trying desperately to sort the worms out from the compost so that I could measure a pound of worms and mail them to different places around the country. I became a drop shipper. You guys didn't know what this, you had no idea, did you? So, it didn't come up in the search process, did it? So, that's why the Indian restaurant, when I go in there now, they always say, do you still have your worms? And when I go to the hardware store where I took the kids to ask for supplies for the hygiene kits, they said, hey, it's the worm lady. And my daughter's friend looked at me because she didn't know. She didn't know about that history. At one point, they were special ordering PVC pipe connectors for me so that I could build all of my build all of my composters. So, at one point, I did the math, and I calculated that I had over 300 gallons of compost and worms going simultaneously in my mother's backyard and garage when I just added up like all of the different Rubbermaid tubs, the number of flow-through composters that I had going in the garage, and I calculated it out. It was about 300 gallons. And I was picking up around, probably about between 50 and 100 gallons of food every single day from different restaurants around the area. Coffee grounds from cafes, an Indian restaurant, and another cafe that made sandwiches. And you know what's interesting about it, though? Is it was one of the coolest things I've ever done. Because then I was able to give away worms on like Craigslist when people wanted to put together a composter. One of the schools contacted me and asked if I could, they could have one of my flow-through composters if I could come talk to the kids about it. People in town knew me. Okay, they knew me as the worm lady, but they knew me. And all of a sudden, we had community where everything was working in harmony with one another. Do you see that? They were able to sell their sandwiches and their Indian food and their coffee, and they knew that they were creating zero green waste that was going to the landfills. It was going to actually feed animals that would then go into different people's gardens to help them make a better compost to have healthier organic plants. So pesticide use went down. Composting went up. Green waste going to the landfill went down. And everybody was working together to make it happen, and all of a sudden we had community, and it was healthy, and it thrived. So when we look at how the creation story lays out our relationship to the earth, on the macro level, it's very orderly and everything's interconnected, but on the micro level, it's so true. The more we take care of the earth, the more we're able to take care of ourselves and community thrives. I'm going to say that one more time. The more we take care of the earth, the more we're able to take care of ourselves. And then community thrives. Can I get an amen to that?